Ajaz, and I apologize in advance if I mispronounced the name, against the Fairfax County Department of Family Services. Mr. Bodner for the appellant in this case. And who is arguing for the Fairfax County?
I'm May Shalal Ketter.
Shalal Ketter?
Yes, sir.
All right, thank you.
Ketter is fine.
All right, Mr. Bodner.
Good morning, Your Honors. I am Mark Bodner, representing Lubna Ajaz. We have two assignments of error.
Would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I would like to reserve 3 minutes, if I may, Your Honor.
Sure.
Two arguments, of course, and our first one that you note from the brief is that we believe that the trial judge erroneously shifted the burden of proof, and I don't mean just shifted the burden of producing evidence. But
well, the trial court certainly inquired about whether the burden of proof had shifted. I think that's pretty clear, but looking at, I guess it's page 692 of the joint appendix, it seems to me that the court clarified that, and I don't know if I can find the exact quote, but it seems to me the court stated words to the effect that the burden remained with the department. Why is that? Why would
right.
not be the case?
She announced that at the, in her ruling. She had obviously gone back, looked at it, and decided in her mind that that was the proper rule of law. I believe
it is the proper rule of law.
Yes, of course it is. But notwithstanding that, I think that she acted, she behaved, and treated the evidence as if it was Ms. Ajaz's burden to produce evidence to counter evidence that, quite frankly, the Department of Family Services never adduced. For example, and there's some overlap between this argument and our next argument relative to the assignment of error relative to the clear and convincing evidence. The department did not produce any evidence showing that Ms. Ajaz did not have housing. And they didn't present any evidence showing that Ms. Ajaz did not have employment or a job. And the department didn't adduce any evidence in its case to show that she didn't have income. And the judge is troubled by all this. In fact, she announces her concern with this twice. You remember that the trial was divided into 3 days. The first day of trial was in June. It was continued to November 3rd and November 4th. In June, before the department rested, she said twice, I better have these documents. I better have these documents. She was insisting, although she did not directly address Ms. Ajaz and say, you bring these. She said, I have to have written evidence of your son's immigration status. I have to have written evidence of your employment, of her employment, and I have to have written evidence of what your housing situation is, your stability. So in the judge's mind, she is placing the burden on my client, who doesn't have to disprove the department's case. She's placing the burden on her to disprove the department's case. And she carries that through to the end of the case when she says, I can accord you no credibility to any testimony that you've given because you didn't produce these documents for me. You didn't give evidence of a written document of immigration. You didn't show me pay stubs for your employment. You didn't show me evidence that your father's supporting you, your family's supporting you.
Well, couldn't that equally be interpreted as the court saying, you have not corroborated your own testimony and I'm not crediting it? And that would be perfectly permissible if that were the case.
It would be, wouldn't it, Your Honor? But for the fact that Ms. Ajaz presented corroborative evidence. She presented a written lease showing that she had housing. And she presented the evidence of her home-based worker, Aaron Hopper, who testified that he'd been to her home 4 times to supervise visits with the child. And in fact, the department's own worker, Magda Alarcon, said in response to cross-examination, she said, I have no reason to believe that Ms. Ajaz has not lived in stable housing for the past 3 months. So that's positive evidence that corroborates all these things that the judge claimed Ms. Ajaz had the burden of proving, when in fact it was the department's burden to prove.
The court didn't claim that. Your argument is that the court did that. As Judge Humphreys pointed out, the court specifically disclaimed that. It was her burden.
That's what the court's announcement was, but the court said, I cannot accord you any credibility because you did not produce these documents. And the evidence that I just recited to Your Honors from the appendix shows that she had positively corroborated. It wasn't her bare testimony that I have these things. She presented corroboration of these facts. And in fact, I would suggest to you that because of the rule in Cheatham, and I gave you a string of citations in the reply brief related to the Cheatham rule, the Virginia Supreme Court's longstanding rule going back to the 1930s even, that The judge cannot arbitrarily disregard uncontradicted, not inherently inconsistent evidence just because the judge wants to do that. And as I want to repeat myself, but just to be clear with the court, that the department never presented evidence that Ms. Ajaz did not have these things. So the evidence that she had housing, that she had employment.
Well, let's forget all of that. What about the evidence regarding, well, you know, the child was in foster care for, what, 30 months prior to the termination hearing? There was evidence, I think, that was unrebutted about the, in a 30-month period, I think the mother had visited only 7 times. There was, irrespective of the housing, there certainly was evidence the child had not been placed in school, and that the child and the family had moved quite often from place to place without being registered for school in any of those places, correct?
There was some reference to that, Your Honor, but they didn't go into any detail. What they indicated was that she was living in Florida. She went to Houston to visit with family.
But I think what we need to establish, and Judge Russell alluded to this a moment ago, this is not a de novo review. I may very well have come to a different conclusion.
I understand that.
The evidence is whether there's evidence in the record to support what the trial court actually did.
Yes, there is some evidence, but the evidence wouldn't rise to clear and convincing. And, Judge, for those reasons, they didn't go into detail about, in fact, the record is devoid to show what school the child missed. All they showed was that she was living in Florida, she went to Texas for 4 days, and then she came to Virginia to look for work in the middle of the school year. But the department didn't show any evidence that the child was educationally lacking, that he'd been pulled out of school.
Did the evidence establish that your client didn't comply with court-ordered services?
Yes, the evidence showed that she was very suspicious of the people who were working with her, and in particular, Ms. Alarcon, the department's agent, and that because of this, she resisted the psychological evaluation that with the department's approved psychologist, that she was suspicious, and she felt from the outset, her evidence was at the outset, and I don't think it's contradicted, the department's agent said to her, we're going to take your child from you, and you're not going to get your child back. So my client was suspicious, and yes, for the reasons I've just given you, she deferred seeing those experts. But ultimately, she went to see those experts, and what did those experts say? They said she had an anxiety disorder, and they said that she had a paranoid personality disorder, but they never really addressed the severity of that. In fact, Dr. Ling, the psychologist, was speaking in generalities. He said, well, some people have this problem, and other people have more extreme problems. And neither one of the experts, either Dr. Ling, the department's psychologist, nor Dr. Stegg, the psychiatrist, tied any of Ms. Ajaz's failings in providing housing, employment, or for the child's care to these particular conditions, except to say a person with these conditions might fixate on details and they might miss the larger picture. And because she's focusing on her anger with the agency's worker, she may be doing things that are not in the best of judgment, not in the best interest. But none of them said that she's incapable of parenting. In fact, the evidence of their experts shows that she functioned at an extremely high level, that she had high cognition. Dr. Stegg said that she didn't need parenting classes. I think Dr. Ling said that as well, that she showed ability to parent, and she showed knowledge in what parenting requires. So in no way did the department's expert evidence support a clear and convincing finding. Even though you use a deferential standard when you review what the trial judge did, there was just not sufficient evidence to show that her particular failings, and as this court and I think the Supreme Court has said before, we don't expect a model parent to come out of this. We expect a parent to substantially remedy the conditions that led to the child's placement. And I'll note that at one point in the appendix, the joint appendix, I think it's at page 523, it was the trial judge's conclusion that she was expected to remedy, not remedy substantially, but remedy the conditions within the 12-month period set forth in the statute. So I submit to your honors that with the plain error I pointed to, arbitrarily rejecting the objective and corroborated evidence of her progress after the child's removal.
Do you have any arguments regarding whether or not she, there's evidence in the record that shows she did, as you put it, substantially remedy the conditions which caused the foster care placement in the first place?
I'm sorry, Your Honor was asking me for what particular?
Well, I heard you argue that because you assert the trial court ruled that because she had not remedied as opposed to substantially remedied, and I
yes.
guess my question to you was simply, what evidence in the record do you point to suggest that she substantially remedied the conditions which caused the foster care placement in the first place?
In addition to the 7 personal visits, and most of them were recent, you'll remember from the record that the department suspended her visits for a period of time due to a verbal disagreement with the agency's worker. She visited the 7 times in person. She had regular telephone visitation with the child. She had supervised visits. The home-based worker, Aaron Hopper, testified without contradiction that he recommended that she have increased visitation, albeit supervised, that the number of visits should be increased. So if the home-based worker, and he said that they were affectionate, they were natural, she acted as a parent with the child with the parent, due to the natural relationship with them, he was basically testifying that the contact should be increased. In fact, that was his testimony. So there is that progress. She had the house. She went to the doctors. She was taking the medication, although there is some evidence in the record that she wasn't taking the medication with the regularity that the judge wanted her to take it. But she did all these things in an effort to remedy the conditions that led to her child's placement. And I would say that she went, you have to conclude from this record that she went quite far. Are you going to ask me, is there some evidence in the record to show that this lady had problems and that she has these mental diagnoses that the department's experts gave her? Yes, there's going to be some evidence of that. But I don't. My position is that evidence couldn't possibly sustain a finding that the judge didn't commit plain error in disregarding the other extensive evidence that I've recounted to you this morning. I'll answer any other questions if Your Honors have any.
All right. Thank you, Counsel. You have 3.5 minutes left.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Cater?
Your Honors, at the outset, I'd like to introduce the guardian ad litem for the child, Seema Richandani, and she has asked for 2 minutes of my time.
She advised me of that earlier. Okay.
I apologize. So if I can cede 2 minutes of my time Ms. Richandani. Your Honors, may it please the Court, Maishal Al-Keder on behalf of the Department of Family Services. The department, plain and simply in this case, proved by clear and convincing evidence that Ms. Ajaz failed to remedy substantially the conditions that brought this child into care. In addition, the court not only found that she had failed to remedy these conditions, but they also found that it was in Syed's best interest to sever this relationship. In the 30 months between the time of the removal and the time of the circuit court case, and now we're sitting here 3.5 years since he came into care, while Mr. Bodner raises several points regarding the shifting of burdens and insufficiency of the evidence, the fact remains that before 2 different tribunals, the department met its burden.
And well, let me ask you about just the one example that your opponent made, and that's regard to the housing. He asserts that the burden shifted by the trial court requiring evidence of housing, and although it was provided, it was a lease that was signed a matter of, I think, days or something before the hearing.
Right.
But is what's your position with respect to the burden there? If you're going to assert that the child wasn't being provided with housing, isn't it your burden to show that is actually the case, and where's the evidence in the record of that?
Well, yes, but here's how I respond to that, and that is that the issue wasn't simply housing. The issue was stability.
No, I'm using that as one example.
Right.
I'm just to take that as an example, one of the bases for the trial courts really was the failure to provide housing, and if it's not your burden to establish lack of housing, and as you assert the trial court wasn't shifting the burden, where is the evidence of that? Is it simply the lack of any lease prior to the one that was put in the record?
In each of the foster care service plans, which were incorporated into the court's orders, there was an order for Ms. Ajaz to maintain to maintain contact with the department, to keep them apprised of her address, and to keep them apprised of where her housing was. So she was under a court order. She was under an obligation.
So it isn't that she didn't do it, because we don't know if she did or not. Your position is that she didn't provide the information as ordered by the court to social to family services.
That's correct, which simply continued to show her lack of follow-through on court orders and her lack of ability to maintain the stability and to show that she was maintaining the stability that was necessary for her to get this child back. And even assuming that all that Mr. Bodner says is true and all of what the court asked for was not provided, those were not simply the bases for this determination. There was the best interest standards and there were the other standards. In this case, actually, Judge Nordland made it a point to state that she found Ms. Ajaz's credibility to be nil, not only because she didn't provide the documents, but she said, I've been watching her. I've been watching her through the 3 days of testimony. She is agitated. She's clenching her jaws. Her pupils are dilated. She was the one who observed all of these things. So it wasn't a matter of the credibility lacking because of a lack of documentary evidence. There was a lack of credibility because of the way that the witness testified, the way that her demeanor. And she, as the trier of fact, was the one who was tasked with weighing the evidence before her and assessing the credibility of each of the witnesses that came before her, including the two experts who testified and the other witnesses who were there. So the agitation, the jaw clenching, et cetera, in addition to the testimony of those witnesses, the court referred to the mother's testimony that was vague and that this supposition was supported by Dr. Stegg, who said that when he interviewed her as well, she was vague, she was evasive during the interview portions of his interview with her. And it went to the paranoid personality from which she suffers. And I would submit to the court also that that Dr. Ling and Dr. Stegg, while they said that she was a high-functioning person, she's a very well-educated individual, but the fact remains that because of her paranoid personality disorder, her prognosis from both of them was very guarded because they were concerned that she would go off her meds if she wasn't under what Dr. Ling described as the watchful eye of the court and of the agency. She made statements such as she testified that she did not need parenting help. She further testified that she was exactly the same person and she was functioning exactly the same as she was in May of 2012. That in and of itself shows that she failed to remedy the conditions that brought the child into care because she herself is telling the court that she is exactly the same person that she was 3 years ago when the child had come into care. Not only did she not follow through on the court orders, but she also, as further demonstration of her paranoid personality disorder, said that she needed to leave the state of Virginia because people were after her.
Help me from having to look it up.
Certainly.
Was it the conditions that caused the child to be placed in foster care in the first place, was that based on the failure to obey the interim orders below, the juvenile court orders, or was there something more than that?
The child's initial removal happened as a result of, first the mother showed up in Virginia, called 911 in order to find a hotel. when she found the hotel, the police had notified Child Protective Services that they were concerned about her actions. The CPS worker then went to the hotel, tried to have a conversation with Ms. Ajaz. She paced back and forth. She was very agitated. The worker was concerned. She tried to get Woodburn Mobile Crisis Unit out to try to assess the mother, which I think ultimately
What was the concerns about the child? I guess that's my the thrust of my question.
Well,
that caused the child to be placed in foster care. I understand the mother's issues.
And so the back and forth between the mother and the CPS worker at the time indicated that the mother was making statements such as she was going to walk to D.C. to try to find a job, she was going to get Obama to give her a job.
I understand that would cause some concern, but still, in order to place a child in foster care, there has to be some evidence of danger or risk to the child.
Right.
What is that?
Well, the danger or risk to the child was that The question that came from the CPS worker was, will you stay here long enough so that we can make an assessment, so that we can make some sort of a family assessment as to the safety of this child? And she refused. She said no.
Was there an unwillingness to sign a safety plan at that time as well?
There was an unwillingness to sign anything. There was an unwillingness to continue on. She Ms. Ajaz continued to tell the worker, as was stated in the testimony from Ms. Louie, was that she kept telling her that it was none of her business, that she wasn't going to cooperate and that she didn't want to talk to anybody, she didn't want to have anybody's help. This after stating that she had gone from Florida to Houston reportedly to look for a job or to visit friends, but she actually only ended up staying there for 3 days, then went to Baltimore, then went to Virginia.
I don't want to use up all your time. I guess the point I'm trying to get at is simply, and it's a question of whether or not the thrust of the foster care placement was...
It was the mental instability of the mother.
So in other words, there was concerns about the child based on the mother's apparent mental instability.
That's correct.
No actual evidence of the child being abused or neglected or anything else at that point, correct?
That's correct. Were there physical marks on the child? No, there weren't.
No, child not being fed or schooled or anything like that. The family services had no knowledge of any of that. They were just concerned at the time about the mother's behavior.
That's correct?
Correct. Well, then, if that's correct, then the remedy is obviously, if that's the conditions that caused the child to be placed in foster care, then the remedy expected would be remedying the
underlying psychological issues,
which are psychological in nature. And but the question then becomes, though, as far as that's a different question from termination of parental rights and whether that's in the best interest of the child. So you can have arguably you can have a parent who suffers either a physical or emotional disability of some sort or impairment.
Correct.
And still be a good parent and still basically provide basic parental supervision and that sort of thing. What's the evidence here that that wasn't taking place?
The evidence here is that when you have a parent who has a psychological or psychiatric condition and they are remedying it by either seeing a therapist or a psychiatrist or a psychologist on a regular basis, and they continue to take their medications and they continue to do what is prescribed by those professionals, then you have a parent who is functioning and who is fully available and who is willing and able to remedy essentially the condition that brings the child.
From a legal standpoint, we don't lightly take children away from their parents.
Right.
It's got to be in the child's best interest, and there's certainly a constitutional, you know, interest that the parent can exercise.
Absolutely.
And so it seems to me, and the statute is written the way the statute is written, but the point is, before we terminate, there's nothing wrong with putting a child in foster care as a precautionary measure in the abstract, but before we terminate parental rights, it seems to me the law is pretty clear that we don't simply take the position, well, we could probably find some better parents out there for him somewhere, so let's just do that. I mean, if the child is not being hurt or suffering in any way, and is being properly fed and schooled and clothed and otherwise provided for, it seems to me that it's of no moment, or at least no legal moment from our standpoint, whether or not the parent or the mother in this case has emotional or mental or psychological issues that need to be remedied.
Right.
At some point. The question is, what was the impact on the child?
Well, except that in this case, the child's therapist testified that there were issues that the child had. He had enuresis when he came into care. He was wetting the bed regularly, as was indicated by the foster mother as well when she testified. He was waking up in the middle of the night. He was having nightmares. He was scared. He was not doing well emotionally himself.
So your evidence is, I hear you arguing in essence from the, basically circumstantially, the evidence of the child being harmed by the parental relationship is the fact that the child thrived when the parental relationship was suspended. Is that correct?
That is certainly part of it, but again, we get to vet foster parents. We don't get to vet biological parents, and so I certainly wouldn't make the argument that the only reason that he's doing better is because he's in a nice home and, you know, has a white picket fence and all of those sorts of extraneous factors. No, the fact is that not being regularly exposed to the psychological instability is what allowed him to thrive in foster care and what allowed him to go on in those 3 years and do well in school and have friends and do all of the things that are described in the record. That's That's where the issue becomes when a biological parent has psychological issues and refuses to address those issues, that's when the impact on their parenting is most apparent. And that is when we have to take the step of terminating parental rights. It's certainly not something that the county takes lightly either. And the natural relationship between parent and child is something that's constitutionally protected, and protected in nature as well. I mean, but in this particular case, this is a child who was exposed for a long period of time to the psychological
instability. If you want the guardian to have 2 minutes, you need to wrap it up very quickly.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Seymour Chindani for the guardian ad litem for the child. Your Honors, in Wood versus Halifax, this court ruled that it is clearly not in the best interest for a child to spend a lengthy period of time waiting to find out when or if a parent will be capable of resuming his responsibilities. And I submit to Your Honors, this is the case at point. The statute provides 12 months. This termination happened 30 months after the child was in care. And though the appellant brief states that the mother's actions weren't looked at and she substantially complied, the child came into care in May 2012. She did not complete a psychological, which clearly is the reason that the child came into care, until November 2013. That's almost a year and a half after the child came into care. And that's 2 weeks before the first termination hearing was held in juvenile court. That's how long it took for her to do one test for this child that she so desperately wanted back and that we desperately wanted to keep with her.
What about the argument that was made that she did relatively well on the tests, that it may have taken an impending deadline to get her to comply, but when she did well?
This is the test that was, there were several psychologists. The one that was done by Dr. Ling, what Dr. Ling testified to was, let me find it in my record. He testified that she was not reporting symptoms of anxiety, but testing showed that she had significant difficulty with anxiety and being mistrustful and suspicious of others. He also testified that the data that he used to examine Ms. Ejaz was that she was suffering from a delusional disorder, but there was just not enough for him to make a diagnosis. So he did diagnose her with anxiety disorder, rule out psychotic disorder, because she just wasn't being open with him. He also testified that she doesn't have proper insight into her circumstances that required her son being in foster care, and that she gave him varying reasons for being in the United States, as well as varying years for being in the United States. She told him she came in 2010 for contract position, and then she told him she came in 2009 for doing studies. So even the psychologist, all of them testified that this woman has different varying psychological illnesses that require long-term care, always under the direction of support. She had no family in this country. We tried desperately to get her the support, to reach out to the family, all to no avail. In the child's best interest, I ask you to support the decision that the circuit court made and to uphold the decision of terminating parental rights.
Thank you. Ms. Rodden?
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'd like to briefly come back to what Judge Humphreys asked about the initial placement, because I think that's significant. You know, you'll remember what the record showed is that when Ms. Ejaz arrived here with her child by plane, she went to a mosque. She took a cab to a mosque to find housing. Obviously, she didn't know anybody here. She had money on her. When the police took her to the Sheraton in Tyson's Corner, she checked into a hotel room. She had $300 on her. She booked a room for 4 days. As you indicated, there was no indication of any kind of deprivation with the child. And all this business about the harm that counsel has told you that the child has suffered before they had this initial contact with the agency is totally speculation, because there's no evidence of any harm to the child. In fact, when they tell you that the child had enuresis when placed in foster care, that he had nightmares, how do we know that that wasn't due to the placement, his separation from his mother in the first instance? They didn't present any evidence to show that that was due to the mother.
But except for the counter-argument, I'm not trying to do their job for them, but they're not going to get up again, but I guess the counter-argument would be Well, the child stopped having nightmares then and adjusted in essence, the child thrived, I think, is the way the report phrased it.
The child adjusted. Children are resilient, as we know, but they didn't prove that the mom was the cause. And again, they have the burden of proving by clear and convincing evidence that this is the case. I want to point out, Ms. Ketter points out to you that there are many instances of what they wanted to prove in the foster care plans. They did not move the foster care plans or any of those documentary evidence into evidence. What happened at the outset of the trial, and there's a brief mention in our opening brief that what Ms. Ketter said to Judge Nordland is, here's a copy of our book with certified copies of the documents, and the judge says, okay, I've given this to the clerk. Now, the judge didn't say, do you have any objections to this to counsel? Didn't ask counsel if there is, Ms. Ketter didn't introduce it into evidence. She just said, I've given the book up here. So I don't think this court can rely on that as evidence in the record.
There's no objection made, though.
Well, she wasn't given the opportunity to make an objection because it wasn't properly introduced.
Was
she didn't
there?
Say, I'd like to.
Was she there? Did she not stand up and. Excuse me.
Well, she could have. I understand, Your Honor.
It's an adversary process. Obviously, you're supposed to represent your client.
Yes, but my point is, I think that it was incumbent upon the department to say, Your Honor, we move these documents into evidence. The judge can then say, is there an objection to this? None of that.
Certainly an objection would have been well taken.
Yes, no question about that.
The way the system operates, we depend on objections.
Right.
If nobody objects, it's the law of the case.
Well, we don't know that it was admitted. The judge didn't mark it. Didn't identify it as an exhibit.
As far as we're concerned, though, it's part of the record.
I agree, because counsel asked me to make it part of the appendix, and I think I have the obligation to do that. I don't think that it's evidence at this court.
Were they made a part of the court's orders?
Not the circuit courts. Not the circuit court's orders, the lower court's orders. And, in fact, the lower court's orders were part of the documents that obviously Ms. Ketter wants you to rely on.
Well, the foster care plans were not a part of the termination of parental rights per se. They were a part of the foster care proceedings right. In juvenile court, which were not appealed to the circuit court. Am I correct on that?
No, I think they were appealed to the circuit court. Not exceptions to the foster care plans, but objections to the final foster care plan that called for permanency planning for adoption. That certainly was appealed.
So the initial
and it's
removal
before this
was
court.
Never appealed.
I'm sorry, Your
Honor. Initial removal, that's Judge Alley's question.
The initial removal was appealed, and then the appeal was withdrawn. I'm sorry to clarify that. I see my time is up, but there is one thing I want to leave you with, if I may.
It's very quick.
Yes, it'll be very quick. They talk about the condition of the child and the child's relationship to the mother and the mother's psychological, psychiatric condition. I want your honors to remember, when you go to decide this case, look at Aaron Hopper's testimony at pages from 373 to 380 of the joint appendix, and you will see his description of Ms. Ajaz's interactions with her child, even after the separation. This is when the visitation resumed, the personal in-person visitation resumed after the period of separation, because it is a very positive appraisal of the mother-child relationship. And I appreciate what Your Honor said about this court not lightly terminating a parent. I agree with you. I think that, well, you haven't told me what your ruling is, but I am of the belief that this is more a custody case than it is a termination case. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, counsel. We will come down and recounsel the